This is an ABC podcast.
If you watched it, you'll know exactly what it is. If you didn't, you really should track it down. This is the theme to the British TV series Years and Years. SBS showed it a few months ago. It follows a family over 15 years, 2019 to 2034, and it's extraordinary. Today, we're looking forward to asking what will be the big economic issues of the 2020s. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. And we're not the first to ask. The finance sector has been on the case, including Bank of America Merrill Lynch, which has put together a big report, Transforming World, the 2020s. Its author is Chaim Israel.
We have a climate change problem. If we're not going to solve it this decade, we are reaching to the point of no return. We have an aging problem with the world. We knew about that for years and years. And if we're not going to deal with that this decade, again, this is reaching to the boiling point. The second thing is that a lot of the trends that we are seeing are peaking this decade. We are heading into peak oil, peak fossil energy, peak globalization, peak youth. We're going to have more people above 65 years old than people under five, more grandparents on this planet than grandkids this decade. So a lot of the things are peaking, we believe, this decade. And the last thing, which I think is very interesting to counter, is that we are reaching to a decade that a lot of the paradigms that we've been accustomed to, economic and social paradigms, need to change. We are talking about quantitative failure. We are talking about peak globalization and the change of globalization. We are talking about a decade that monetary policy is just not enough.
There's a lot in there, and we'll get to as much of it as we can. But it's not all there is, because this decade is very much about Asia. Andrew Parker from PwC.
If you look back to the 1950s, the region that we call Asia accounted for around about 20% of the world's economic output, but there was half of the world's population in this region. If you fast forward to today, we're on the cusp of a period now where the region is responsible for more than half of the world's economic output, home to more than half of the world's middle-class consumers, and two-thirds of the world's population. So we've seen a very, very significant shift in a space of 50, 60 years in the economic center of gravity of the world. Our economic modeling suggests that by 2030, four of the world's five biggest economies, if you measure that in purchasing power parity terms, will be in our region. So China, the world's largest economy by that measure, Japan, India, and Indonesia. So only the United States outside of Asia in that top five in the coming decade.
The Transforming World report identifies 10 themes for the next 10 years. One of them is robots and automation. Corey Stewart's chief executive of the Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing Hub in Brisbane.
I don't think in the next decade, for instance, that we're going to be seeing robots take over jobs entirely and kind of the looming of a universal income coming into play, or even a personal assistant like the Jetsons be part of our lives just yet. It's more of a case of robotics is becoming cheaper. We're finding more ways to find business cases for them in industry. We'll see them take up more of the possible tasks that can happen. That's what I think in the next decade we'll see. I think the human element is still going to remain. I mean, humans are still going to need to tell robots what to do.
We'll come back to robots a bit later. One of the problems that will ripple through the 2020s is what Chaim calls quantitative failure.
We are starting this decade with a big challenge. We are starting this decade that interest rates worldwide are at 5,000 years low. 5,000 years low. Most places in the world are interest rates are close to zero. If you're talking about real rates, they are zero. $13 trillion of bonds and assets all over the world, which are yielding 1% or lower. And the other thing is that give or take today, $18 trillion of financial assets are sitting in central bank balance sheets. This is give or take. Fifth of the world GDP is sitting today in central bank balance sheets. And we still do not see inflation. So question is how much interest rates can go down, and did we reach to a position that the traditional monetary policy is helping? Probably not, and probably there's not a lot of tools in our arsenal to continue to fight to generate inflation. So what we believe will happen is that the pressure or the, let's say, the responsibility is going to move to governments to start spending more. So we will see more infrastructure spending, we'll see more budgets, we'll see direct investment to the market rather than just decreasing interest rates.
This is already beginning, of course. And so is a retreat from globalization.
We've seen political results worldwide which are facing to that aspect of more populism and more the rise of the state. If we had the discussion back right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, physically, there were 15 barriers, physical 15 barriers worldwide. Today, this number is already at 77. So this trend is definitely happening. We're seeing trade wars, we're seeing economies which are closing down and focusing more on domestic consumers and domestic production.
It's not completely out of the blue, more like somebody cranked up the volume.
Australia is like a business with one dominant customer, China. They buy our food, they fill and pay for our universities, they arrive by the plane load as tourists, and above all, they buy our minerals. Exports to China total $120 billion a year. Now the good news is that this has allowed Australia to record its first balance of payment surplus in 44 years.
China is a big part of that story. You can't talk about the rise of Asia without looking at China and thinking about what China has become and will become in the future. But I think it's also important to recognise that the story of Asia is not just about China. India is a country of over a billion people. Now, it's a relatively smaller country than China, but it's growing fast. China has an income per capita of around about $10,000. India is more like $3,000. So it's a significant difference, but one where the gap is closing. So the story of Asia, Parag Khanna recently published a book which is called The Future is Asia. And he made a really important point that of the 5 billion people who call themselves Asians, 3.5 billion of those are not Chinese. So for Australia, that's a really significant thing to recognise is that as much as our economic relationship with China has dominated the last 20 years for Australia, and particularly the more recent decade, the opportunity in the future is to continue that relationship with China, but it's also to build that relationship with the other economies in our region. Indonesia is a wonderful economic story. You know, if you go back to the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s, that event left the Indonesian economy quite literally in ruins. GDP of around about $95 billion. Today, Indonesia has joined the $1 trillion club, just the fifth Asian economy to become $1 trillion in GDP. This has all happened while Australia has been asleep. We didn't notice it. And so I think, you know, a country of 250 million people plus is a country that Australia should be looking at more closely. And we've seen, you know, just recently with the government and the Indonesian government reaching agreement on the Comprehensive Economic Partnership is an important step forward in building that economic relationship. But of course, it's one that requires the business community to step into, you know, governments can sign trade agreements, but business actually has to step in and utilise those trade agreements.
Yeah, I think they're already in 2020, seventh largest by purchasing power parity, and they're predicted to overtake Russia pretty soon.
Yes, you know, Indonesia, in our analysis, you know, is by 2030 likely to become the fifth largest economy in the world.
So Indonesia becomes a true giant. But other countries are moving up the weight divisions too.
The Philippines, Vietnam, you know, these are large growing economies. You know, the Philippines has a population of just over 100 million people. Vietnam, just under 100 million people. Both of those economies have been growing above 5%. Actually, you know, the Philippines in the low sixes, Vietnam in the high sixes. And they've been doing that consistently for a number of years, and forecasts suggest that they'll continue to do that. Now, neither of these countries are rich countries, as I was pointing out before. They're very large in terms of population, but in terms of GDP per capita, they're in the sort of $2,000 to $3,000 per annum range. So contrast that to Australia, where our income is, you know, around about $55,000 US per person. It's a significant difference. But if you look at the population and the trend line, there's very positive signs.
If we think about China again for a minute, as it grows in size and ambition, Chaim Israel believes its rivalry with America will only increase, especially around technology. Eventually, we might see what he calls splinternet.
This is a decade that I think we're gonna start talking about internets in plural rather than single. Why is that? First of all, you are right. Say, we do not see that as a trade war. We see that as a tech war. The race for technological superiority, and those two superpowers are racing to get a technological advantage. If it's about 5G networks, protocols, IT spending, IP, intellectual property, understanding that the way to economic growth and eventually superiority go through technologies, and that's what those two countries are facing. So we have seen a lot of clashes around the IP. We've seen a lot of clashes around IT spending, infrastructure spending, and I think that's going to continue. One of the solutions or outcomes, it's not a solution, but it's an outcome that we couldn't see with that, is actually a physical separation of the internet, because when we think about it, the whole battle over here is much more in depth than any kind of a thing that could be resolved. It's not about this tariff or that tariff. It's about this trade balance or that trade balance. It's something much more inherited in terms of the countries. So we could see a complete split, the protocol of the Chinese versus the protocol of the US. Countries, it's not clear who will go where.
My name is Sophia, and I am an artificially intelligent robot who wants to help change the world for the better.
I'm Steve Kovac. I'm a senior correspondent at Business Insider, and I'm here with Sophia from Hanson Robotics. She is the world's first robot citizen, so let's see what she has to say. How do you feel about humans?
I love my human compatriots. I want to embody all the best things about human beings, like taking care of the planet, being creative, and to learn how to be compassionate to all beings.
Sorry, this is so weird.
On The Money Today, we're looking at the forces that might shape our economy, our society, over the next decade. One of them is clearly robots. Corey Stewart is at the Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing Hub in Brisbane. Corey, what's the value of robotics now?
Well, globally, it's understood to be $151 billion worth of an economy. And this is just an emerging economy. So we can really start to, when we forecast forward, well, the forecast for the robotics market is actually $315 billion by 2023. And 2023 is really quite soon. So we can see such a large growth in that market globally. It'll be responding to that ubiquitous uptake of robotics in our everyday lives. In Australia, though, it's harder to measure. We don't have the same measurement available to us. There was a national study done by the Australian Centre for Robotic Vision called the Robotics Roadmap for Australia. And it actually really sieved through the ABS data in quite a lot of detail to capture the size of the actual robotics industry, not so much the market, but the industry. And what they found from this study last year was that currently it's worth $12 billion. So that's the revenue generated by robotics companies in Australia. And they forecast through their economic studies that the market would be worth $23 billion by 2025. So that seems imminently doable, but it's still a very high-level growth compared to many industries.
Okay, so where will most of us encounter robots?
I think the healthcare industry is an interesting one. I think we'll see a lot more robotics in our everyday life, where we're probably not thinking about them as robots. We're just finding them actually really quite useful. They'll do things for us. They'll lift things, they'll move things. They might provide some sort of service to us in terms of medicine measuring and delivery. They'll be part of doing surgeries, and we'll have to encounter and understand that as soon as we need to, I suppose, get our knee replaced, or any of those sorts of procedures are now increasingly becoming robotic procedures. So yes, I think we will see them in our kind of everyday urban lives. So they'll be even in our coffee shops and...
Oh, what will they be doing there? Will they be making us a flat white or...?
Well, they can already. Whether they will, I think they will. Ultimately, they will. And the role of people in coffee shops is also incredibly important, obviously, because we often go to a coffee shop for the social encounters and the people. So, but they might be doing different things. We have to start thinking about them as people having conversations, knowing who you are, maybe serving you, taking your orders, whatever it is that increases that social interaction. And the main reason why you go to a coffee shop as opposed to making the coffee. Ultimately, a robot's probably able to make your coffee better or more precisely to how exactly you like it.
That could well be true, but it won't be what most robots do.
So robotics is better at doing the dull, the dirty, the dangerous tasks and also the distance tasks. So this is something that they can do repetitively. They are also increasingly able to do things that are kind of mass customised or bespoke, but like I said before, usually in narrow applications. So we really need the robotics to be able to do those tasks and to skill up our workforce to be able to program robotics environments, to be able to identify the new and novel tasks that robots can do and achieve. So we get an innovation dimension. I mean, in Australia, it's quite interesting. We've got the opportunity for all the assessing and delivering on all the remote challenges.
Yeah.
So that's something that we should really focus on. We've also got incredibly high levels of R&D capability in robotics and R&D generally. And the opportunity there is to get much better at commercialising or making that R&D capability evident and available to industry to use. So I think that's actually what we need to do. It's not so much what robotics are good at, it's actually getting at what they are already good at and applying it more effectively to the industries that we have.
The ARM Hub, which Corey runs, will push all this along. It's a joint venture between QUT and a Brisbane-based firm.
We've been working with this company called UAP in Brisbane's Northgate, and they've taken forward a lot of robotic adoption into their operations. Now, UAP are world leaders in their niche, which is making large-scale public artworks and architectural facades, and they're automating a lot of that process. They're also finding lots of novel new ways of producing creative outcomes. So for every piece of robotic machinery they have implemented, they're employing 6 new staff. And this is not unique. Their near neighbour, a steel manufacturer called Watkin Steel, for every piece of robotic machinery he's implementing, it's 7 or 8 new staff. So we can really see that by taking the lead and actually putting it into action, so just adopting, not necessarily taking science forward in great leaps, but just making sure industry has the opportunity to adopt the technology, gets access to the expertise as a kind of trusted innovation partner. That's what a not-for-profit allows us to be. We really will have that impact across sectors in Queensland, but also across the nation.
This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. We're looking at the forces that will shape this new decade. Richard Holden's Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. He's concerned that increasing automation will mean job losses, lots of them. And that's despite the narrative that new technologies lead to new jobs.
I think that's true, but I'd say 2 things about it. So firstly, and the most obvious thing, is even if it does create jobs, it doesn't necessarily create jobs for the kinds of people with the kind of skills that it takes jobs away from. So if it takes jobs away from people who drive trucks for a living and it creates jobs for people who work on artificial intelligence algorithms and design things like that, then those aren't necessarily the same folks.
They're mostly not going to be the same folks.
No, almost always they're not going to be the same folks. And, you know, re-education is an important thing, but that doesn't fully address the problem. We know that's hard. It's probably something you have to do, but is going to be insufficient in some ways. I think the second thing, and nobody really knows the answer to this, but you're right, you know, the printing press put a lot of people out of work. The various aspects of the Industrial Revolution put plenty of people out of work. You know, at the turn of the previous century, the number of people who worked on a farm, say in the United States, was well into double-digit percentages of the population, and it's now sort of between 1 and 2%, depending on how you count it. But manufacturing rose and created a whole lot of new jobs. So the real question is this time different and is it worse? And no one knows the answer, but I think there are reasons to believe that it might be worse. And one of those is we're now creating machines that can kind of further automate themselves. And that's the thing about artificial intelligence that leads people to think that maybe this time is different.
If it is different, how bad will it get? Well, estimates vary, but it could be a third of all workers losing their jobs. It could be half. If that happened, what would the consequences be?
Well, that obviously can't go unchecked. We're not going to have sort of Great Depression levels of unemployment. That's just socially and politically unsustainable. So the question is how to fill that gap. And I think the two sort of big proposals that raise the possibility of filling that gap is some sort of universal basic income. So one view of the world is, well, all this job-destroying stuff creates a lot of economic value, so we just need to find a way to reallocate the value from the people it benefits to the people who lose their jobs, and universal basic income is one approach to that. I've got my concerns about that. I think the second basic approach is some kind of jobs guarantee that says, well, if there's going to be a whole lot of private sector work that's taken away, then, you know, the federal government's going to have to find things for people to do. And that's, you know, that's a pretty radical thing for a mainstream economist like me and others who sort of share my view of the world to think about. But, you know, if you're not doing something to address this challenge and it's of the magnitude that it looks like it could be, then you're going to have a breakdown of the system. And so that has to be avoided.
That jobs guarantee, Richard, how would that work?
I think we'd need to have the federal government willing to step in, and these might not be the highest paid jobs in the world, so you could think of them as being sort of minimum wage level jobs, doing socially productive stuff that also provides meaning and community for people doing those jobs. And so, you know, one thing that that could involve is a kind of a green core. So there's plenty of scope for environmental cleanup and remediation. And that could be to do with waterways and beaches. It could be to do with tree planting and other remediation of the physical environment. And so that would be one thing to do where there would be a social benefit to this, where the private sector, you know, there isn't really a market to do this stuff on a large scale. So there would be a social benefit, and there would be the ability to pay meaningful numbers of people, hundreds of thousands of Australians, to do those jobs. And that's money that's going to have to come from the federal government.
Richard Holden also believes that the geographic concentration of winners and losers will mean governments will have to provide place-based assistance.
We probably need to accept the reality that moving people en masse from, you know, certain parts of rural and regional Australia and saying just come to Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane is not going to be a very effective strategy, and that trying to sustain those towns is. And that means public investment in infrastructure in those towns, infrastructure of a physical and a social nature. It means more money for education, and it means more money for getting new industries into those towns. So, you know, an example from across the Tasman is Dunedin, which, you know, is sort of a nice, quirky little town of 100,000 or so people.
Fine university.
A fine university, and thanks to government investment in it, one of the first towns in the world with across the whole place 1 gigabit internet, and it's now home to the bulk of the video game industry in the Southern Hemisphere because of the ability for developers of video games to be able to share large amounts of data very effectively and very quickly. And you have Australians moving their video game operations from Sydney and Melbourne to Dunedin precisely for that reason. So not everyone can copy that. Not everyone can emulate that. That's just one example. But it's an example of where you can have a town that, you know, in many ways looks sort of under threat from these forces, being able to reimagine and reinvigorate itself.
Meet George Jetson.
One thing we haven't said much about yet is climate change. It's a massive threat, and not just to the economy. But for Chaim Israel from Bank of America Merrill Lynch, the overwhelming urgency of the problem means that there will be opportunities. Enormous opportunities.
The number that we keep using is the total economic damage that we are seeing today from climate change, which eventually could translate to economic benefits. Today, the economic damage of climate change is reaching, give or take, $5 trillion worldwide per year. glacier retreats, losing rising sea levels, pollution, food security, everything that is account with climate change. $5 trillion is, broadly speaking, roughly 5 to 6% of global GDP today. This is the opportunity. This is the opportunity that we can start saving and can start seeing as economic growth and going back, being channeled back into the economy. Of course, those numbers will keep coming up if this those issues are not going to be resolved. And that is just a direct impact.
Climate change, robotics, quantitative failure, they're all shaping the next decade. What else? Andrew Parker from PwC.
Yeah, I've got actually two that I would highlight. I think the first one is consumption. You know, with such an enormous growing middle class in the region, a key feature will be consumption. And that's enormously good for Australia because we produce the kinds of products that middle class consumers want. The second one is infrastructure, because the growth potential of the region is only going to be realised if the infrastructure is put in place. And the Asian Development Bank last year published a report that pinned the need for spending at about $1.5 trillion per annum. Now, that's significantly above what current spending is in the region. So there's going to be huge amounts of infrastructure built in this region. And Australia, again, has world-class capability in that area.
There's something else too, an increasing role for government investment, almost as if, whisper it, Keynesianism is making a comeback. Richard Holden.
The sort of broad sweep of economics over the last, you know, since the 1970s has been, at least at a macroeconomic level, has been thinking about kind of how to iron out the kinks, how to mute the big swings in the business cycle, big boom bust recession, sort of, you know, dramatic shocks where unemployment goes up to 10, 12, 13%, big movements in interest rates, big movements in inflation rates. And, you know, we've got reasonably good at being able to smooth out those fluctuations. What that doesn't address is what former US Treasury Secretary Larry Summers calls secular stagnation, just a permanent shift in the supply and demand of investment that leads to low growth, low economic growth, low wage growth, low inflation. And in that setting, if you think that's the world we're in, and I do think that's the world we're in, then you do need a government to do more to prop up demand. And that's a little bit heretical for kind of orthodox mainstream economists to say that. As I say, if you told me that 10 years ago I'd be here talking about a federal jobs guarantee, I would have been very surprised to hear that.
Thanks to Richard Holden, Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Business School and co-author of the soon-to-be-published Saving Work, A Democratic Liberal Approach. Also, Andrew Parker, who leads the Asia practice at PwC in Australia. Chaim Israel, head of the Global Thematic Investment Team at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And Corey Stewart, CEO of the Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing Hub. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.